along with conductor Sarah Hicks for several seasons now that we call Inside the Classics, which is sort of a play on the traditional pre-concert talk, where we take one featured piece that we'll perform in full on the second half. And on the first half, Sarah Hicks and I basically have been given carte blanche to do whatever we want, to put the piece in context and to talk about not only the composer, but what were his influences, what were, you know, the other things going on in the world, and to really create a narrative for the music. That's something I think much more, in a much more modern way than simply saying, here are the dates, here is who taught him. You know, the first show we ever did, we needed to bridge a plot gap in Firebird that wasn't in the orchestral suite. So we forced all the first violins to wear tiaras and be princesses. We armed the seconds and violas with axes and staged an attack, which took care of it nicely and also, I think, sort of set the tone. So we've had a certain amount of success with that sort of program as well.
So the music becomes a sort of soundtrack for real life, in a sense.
To a degree, but then the important thing is always that on the second half, I shut up and we just play the music. And we give people a chance to really experience the core of what the orchestra is about.
Yeah. Brian, I know there's one particular broadcast recording that you're extremely fond of. I heard it backstage there and that you'd like to introduce to us. It's a conductor who you worked with, who I think the orchestra is very fond of, and you were in this performance, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. It was a real highlight of that season.
This was Mother Goose, the finale, the magical fairy garden from Mother Goose by Ravel. Would you like to tell us a little bit about that concert?
Well, I started talking about the orchestra was founded in 1903, and in 2003, the orchestra put out the call that any past conductor of their main music directors or principal guest conductors were invited back to have a special week or two in that anniversary season. And they got them all lined up except one gentleman. And one of the most dear figures at Orchestra Holland up to that time was the conductor you know all very well here, Charles Dutoit. He was principal guest conductor for the Minnesota Orchestra for several seasons. And he hadn't been back in years and years and years. And he came back and did an all-French program and ended with this music. And just as we're listening to it to wrap up, at the end of that concert, I still remember the broadcast that night, somebody out in the hall, after the applause was dying down, cupped their hands to their mouth and bellowed out as loud as they could, "Please come back." And this moment, I think, still kind of puts puts goosebumps on the back of my neck as we listen to a little closing segment of Ravel's Mother Goose.
The Fairy Garden from Ravel's Mother Goose Suite. Charles Dutoit was conducting the Minnesota Orchestra in October 2003.
I was talking there to Brian Newhouse and Sam Bergman at our Proms Plus event at the Royal College of Music earlier this evening. The producer was Elizabeth Fumming. You're listening to Radio 3, home of the BBC Proms, and welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall and this prom, which is being given by the Minnesota Orchestra under their music director, Osmo Vanska. And don't forget, you can see the programme for this day and every prom on the BBC Radio 3 website. Now, there's one work on tonight's prom, the second half of tonight's concert, Bruckner's Monumental Fourth Symphony. Well, Brian Newhouse, presenter of the Minnesota Orchestra's concerts on Minnesota Public Radio, is back with me now. Welcome back, Brian.
Thank you, Rob. Thank you.
Before we talk about Bruckner, I just want to talk to you about this hall and the impact it's having on you as a visitor. Oh. They've been here before, the orchestra, but how are they sounding to you in comparison to the way they sound at home?
Oh, I wish I could bring everybody in Minnesota into the hall with me right this moment, because if you've come to Orchestra Hall, you know you're in something of a rectangular shoebox, and here you are in a salad bowl, a big salad bowl, and the base of the bowl, there are no seats, there are about 500 people standing in rapt silence. And the colors are here, a dark red, beautifully lit. Sometimes there are television cameras here that require good lighting, and you just get this a mixture of a chill and a kind of a warm feeling when you walk into this place.
It's
just adore coming to this place.
A sense of an event. Well, yeah. Hearing Bruckner is always an event,
yeah.
At any concert hall, and certainly here where the music seems to expand into the hall and suits the hall, all those wonderful horn calls and woodwind calls you get in the Fourth Symphony. Did Osmo Vanska come to Bruckner recently? Or it was a new discovery for him, was it?
Sure it was. And we have to let people know what's going on right now. These are the prommers downstairs. They're talking about the funds that have been raised for charity.
Right.
And this is an odd thing for Americans to hear.
This is a regular tradition that Brian...
And they announced that they just raised a bunch of money for charity. So good on them.
Yeah, absolutely.
But anyway, Osmo Vanska was raised musically in Finland and was for many years the head of the Lahti Symphony Orchestra in southeast Finland. And that's a band of about 65, 68, maybe 70 players. Now, Bruckner wants to write music for a much bigger orchestra, 90, 95, 100 players. And so Osmo, for many years in Finland, didn't touch Bruckner, didn't touch Mahler, these composers who really wrote on a big, big canvas. So then he comes to Minnesota, which has got 90-plus players, and he is a bit, he's just discovering this music now, you know, in a very mature part of his career. He's approaching, I think, 60 years old, and so this is something he's exploring now for the first time.
And he manages to get from the orchestra extreme dynamics.
Yeah, yeah.
Very, very soft pianissimos, towering fortissimos. I notice that. This is, after all, an extremely... Well, it's an epic work, but it's a very melodic work as well. It's got this chivalrous feel to it. The individual movements originally had titles, and it unfolds a sort of narrative. And listening to him this morning, he seems to connect with that narrative element of the music.
Yeah, he's talked about... You were asking a little bit about the effect of Russia on him before and Shostakovich, but he's also talked to me about how he loves the sense of time that, like, a Russian writer will have. You know, War and Peace is not a short story, okay? And that he likes the big arc, and Bruckner is all about the big arc.
That's absolutely right. Well, Sarah Kwok, the leader of the orchestra, is just cueing the tuning process. Bruckner's Fourth, as I said, one of the problems with it is it exists in a number of editions. I think there are 7 editions. In fact, one of them has a completely different scherzo. And Osmo Vanska has opted for the 1888 version, which was used by the great conductors of the cast. Well, here he comes now, Osmo Vanska, to conduct the Minnesota Orchestra in Bruckner's Fourth Symphony, The Romantic.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Change one string, so use this opportunity and talk to each other.
Well, a string has to be changed. So there's a little bit of a break here between the scherzo and the finale of Bruckner's First Symphony, played here in the 1888 edition by the Minnesota Orchestra.
It's not just any Benske string either. It's the string of the cello of the principal cellist,
right,
Anthony Ross. So he's out front playing some gorgeous solos, and if the string pops, he knows it. So Osmo, instead of having an embarrassing kind of absent cello voice, he said, let's just stop the concert and take care of business right now.
Well, I must say, it's interesting, Brian, the applause after movements. This is something that hasn't always happened at the Proms. I must say, it's very interesting after. It used to happen years ago. Is this something that happens at home?
It does quite a lot. And Osmo says, you know, people love the music. Why not?
I agree.
So they just gave a little bit of applause for the accomplishment of a new string put in. And we're continuing with Bruckner 4.
the uplifting closing bars of Bruckner's Fourth Symphony, the Romantic, played at tonight's prom by the Minnesota Orchestra, conducted by their music director, Osmo Vanska. Well, I've been joined in the box tonight for our concert by Brian Newhouse, who presents the Minnesota Public Radio. Quite an event, that, I think. Brian,
I loved watching Osmo's face as he came to that last page of music. He was just beaming, looking up to especially the brass players, and then turning to the strings. He says, almost to say, okay, come on, let's go. Let's open this up. Let's really give them their money's worth here. Let's really give them a thrill.
And I love the way when he cues very, very quiet playing, he almost stops conducting.
Yeah, yeah.
And you get those pianissimi that you were talking about earlier that are almost inaudible. You just hear the shimmer go through the hall. And, you know, thousands of people gathered here to listen to it. It's quite an achievement to be able to hear such quiet playing.
It really is. And that's something that amazes us in America when we listen to these broadcasts from the proms, how absolutely silent the audience is. Here's a bow for the principal horn player, Michael
yes.
Gast of the Minnesota Orchestra. Beautiful solos that Michael brought.
Yes.
The ensemble. Bert Hara, the principal clarinetist, taking a bow. And John Miller, principal bassoon. Here's Basil Reeve, principal oboe. Adam Kinzel, principal flutes. Now everybody gets to stand, and Osmo. And I was looking back at it now, I really am sorry that they had to stop before the final movement there to let Tony Ross change his cello swing, because it just felt like they were in the middle of the story. And they had to stop. And of course you have to stop. He's such a prominent voice.
But if there was a place to stop, I think after the steps, there was probably a good place.
Yeah.
The divided violins, if listeners have been listening in stereo, mm-hmm. they maybe could listen to the antiphonal interplay between first and second violins, which are placed left and right of the rostrum. That's becoming more and more fashionable, and it helps clarify the sound as well.
This rhythmic applause, I have to tell you, Rob, is something that you don't hear in America. And for an American orchestra, when they come to a foreign venue, this just thrills them. The Minnesota Orchestra players, I'm sure, have got the hair on the back of their neck standing up now. This is just so special.
Well, what are your closing thoughts attending this concert tonight, Brian?
Well, you know what? I see these players week in and week out, and I am looking at people I have known for years, and they've got the look of kids on their face. They are absolutely thrilled to see this hall of 5,500 filled and people just standing and cheering. They are so pleased, and they have every right to be.
Well, Brian Newhouse, they've certainly earned that response. Thank you so much for joining me. Tomorrow night at the Proms, two works played by the Minnesota Orchestra, Berg's Violin Concerto and Beethoven's Ninth Symphony. And on Saturday, CD Review, Osmo Vanska will be talking to Andrew McGregor. But now, I hand you back to Broadcasting House and Ian Skelly.
Rob, thank you very much. At the Royal Albert Hall tonight for us, Rob Cowan, and some very intriguing music throughout the programme, particularly the cello concerto there by Shostakovich. Well worth a second listen, I'd say, which you can do either by going to the Radio 3 website at bbc.co.uk/radio3, then navigating your way to the Listen Again page on the BBC iPlayer, or if you prefer, you can listen into Radio 3 a week today when tonight's prom will feature as that day's BBC Proms Repeat. That's at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And the proms feature at breakfast, too.
On breakfast each morning through the summer proms season, we'll be bringing you the Henry Wood Proms Novelties, pieces of music that Sir Henry Wood introduced to proms audiences for the very first time, going right the way back to the first season in 1895. There are lost gems and works that have become great classics over time. The Henry Wood Novelties in Breakfast on Radio 3 every morning from 7.
Well, back to tonight on Radio 3. Our essay comes from India this evening. It's the final episode in a week when we've been appraising the legacy of the lexicographer Samuel Johnson and his continuing influence on the way we use words today, the way we evaluate that use as well. Well, tonight's essay considers his influence on Indian English. It's given by Rudrangshu Mukherjee, the senior editor of the Calcutta Telegraph, and you can hear his thoughts at 11. After which we travel the world to hear a conversation with Nick Page and Bernard O'Neill about their new project together, also highlights from their set at this year's WOMAD Festival. That's in World on 3 at 11.15. But Friday night's programmes on Radio 3 continue in just over 5 minutes' time with a portrait of the Chilean writer Pablo Neruda. Both sides of his character come under the spotlight, not just his writing, his efforts to help get refugees out of fascist Spain. What does that episode tell us about his character, and how did it affect his work? Closer to Blood Than Ink is at 10 tonight. That's after a statement from one Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart. A gentle antidote to Bruckner's symphony, the 10th of Mozart's piano sonatas, the one in C, Kirkel 330, played there by Lang Lang. This is BBC Radio 3. Pablo Neruda has a reputation as a great poet and an heroic man, but there are aspects of his life and work that fall short of this. Nick Rankin takes a closer look at both in Closer to Blood Than Ink.
This is an extraordinary life. This is a man of words but also action who escaped across the Andes on horseback, rescued 2,000 Spanish refugees on the Winnipeg, this boat that he shipped them out from France to Chile. A man of action, but also a wonderfully rich poet, a poet of extraordinary depth. Carlos Fuentes actually said that he was the King Midas of poetry. Every object he touched, he made a golden poetry out of. I really do feel that he's one of the great poets of the 20th century in any language.
Adam Feinstein, author of A Passion for Life, the latest biography of the man from Chile who changed his name from Neftalí Ricardo Reyes Basoalto to Pablo Neruda, not only because it was simpler and stronger, but aligning himself with European letters, Jan Neruda being the name of a revered 19th century Czech realist poet.
I'd heard a lot from Octavio Paz. I'd heard a lot from a lot of other Latin American writers that I knew. They were almost unanimous in their dislike, their contempt, their disregard for Neruda. For example, I found out that Juan Ramón Jiménez, one of the very great Spanish writers from Spain and a Nobel Prize winner and a Spanish Republican who died in Puerto Rico, had said that if Pablo Neruda was ever awarded the Nobel Prize, he would return his.
Stephen Schwartz is a poet and writer who's been immersed in Hispanic literature since he was a child.
I went back and I looked through the work again because I did some research on the Ode to Stalin when the movie The Postman came out. And I realized this was not a good poet. This was a bad poet.
There are startling changes of tone in his poetry. Some people have criticized that as unevenness. I really don't accept that. I mean, the famous Chilean poet Nicanor Parra, younger poet still alive, who welcomed Neruda back from exile in 1952, he said, yes, Neruda's poetry is uneven, but so are the Andes.
Neruda became famous first by associating himself with a group that we call in Spanish literature the Generation of 1927. García Lorca, Alberti, very talented men, Jorge Guillén, Manuel Alto Laguirre. These were very brilliant poets. He was nowhere near them. He was a hortatory, flabby, gassy guy writing this sort of pseudo-surrealist stuff.
Que por las huellas, que por las hojas del otoño muerto, va machacando el alma hasta la tumba.
I think he was an extraordinary poet. I think the music of his poetry is marvelous. I think his imagery is surprising. He's daring, he's electric. You know, he's one of these poets who, for other poets, I think, opens doors.
The poet Jane Duran, who's lived in Chile and whose father, the composer Gustavo Duran, knew many of the generation of 1927.
And then he gives up modernism and becomes a propagandistic poet for the Communist Party and for Stalin. And then he does these terrible things, a series of really immoral acts. And so I wrote this article called Bad Poet, Bad Man, and I think he was a bad man. I think a person who helped in any way in the assassination of Trotsky, whatever one thinks of Trotsky, it was a terrorist act, is a bad person. I think a person who would take anti-fascist refugees off of an anti-fascist rescue ship is a bad man. And I think that Juan Ramón Jiménez was right, that in the end it's a scandal that he was awarded the Nobel. So,
well,
that's where I'm at.
That's quite a list, Stephen. If you saw the 1995 film Il Postino, or The Postman, from which this music comes, you might be surprised to hear that some people think that the great Pablo Neruda was a bad person and a bad poet. But these are the contradictory views of the man and his work that I'm looking at in this programme. Now, Pablo Neruda won the Nobel Prize for Literature in 1971, just after his socialist friend Salvador Allende was elected president of Chile and he died in September 1973 at the age of 69, just after General Pinochet's coup d'état that overthrew Allende. As the Chilean military junta began torturing and disappearing its enemies within, Neruda's own house was sacked by rampaging soldiery. In the following decades, Pablo Neruda was applauded worldwide as the lyrical poet of love and winningly portrayed as such by Philippe Noiret in Michael Radford's film. Neruda is also remembered as the eloquent poet of the people, someone who could rouse mass rallies in football stadia, a writer who wanted to give a voice to the voiceless and the unheard. Professor Jason Wilson, who's both translated Neruda and written books about him, sees the Chilean poet as divided.
I came up with my own version of two Nerudas. I even made jokes about it. There was a fat and a thin Neruda. And the thin early Neruda was a great introspective poet who took bits from everywhere. He was from the periphery, from the southern forests of Chile, a genuine romantic outsider in every cultural and individual sense. And he was rereading Latin American poetry, French poetry, and in his long exile, self-exile in the Far East, English poetry. And he came up with this sort of amalgam of avant-garde verse without belonging to any orthodoxy. And it was wonderful.
Puedo escribir los versos más tristes esta noche. Escribir, por ejemplo, la noche está estrellada y tiritan azules los astros a lo lejos.
Tonight I can write the saddest lines. Write, for example, the night is shattered and the blue stars shiver in the distance. The night wind revolves in the sky and sings. Tonight I can write the saddest lines. I loved her. Sometimes she loved me too. Through nights like this one, I held her in my arms. I kissed her again and again under the endless sky. She loved me. Sometimes I loved her too. How could one not have loved her great, still eyes?
Ella me quiso. A veces yo también la quería. ¿Cómo no haber amado sus grandes ojos fijos?
But he got to a sort of dead end in the mid-30s with that, with this sort of introspective poetry going into dreams, and even pessimistic. He famously later, from this Marxist point of view, said, well, this poetry is not good for you. I'm not going to allow it to be translated into Russian. It's too pessimistic, too individualistic. And he turned to a much more literal version as he became happier and as the world changed.
The world changed for Pablo Neruda, as for so many others in the 1930s, with the Spanish Civil War, which erupted when General Franco, incidentally Pinochet's model and hero, led a military rebellion against Spain's elected Republican government in July 1936. Neruda was then living in Madrid as a Chilean diplomat. He was becoming estranged from his first wife and their disabled daughter because he'd fallen for an Argentine woman called Delia del Carril, who was a hardline Stalinist. The violence of the Civil War had a shocking impact on Neruda when civilian Madrid was bombed and shelled, and particularly when his friend, the Andalusian poet Federico García Lorca, was brutally murdered in Granada. Adam Feinstein sees this time as a crucial turning point.
It is important, apart from the huge influence of Delia del Carril, his second wife, to be, her communism and her literary criticism, the assassination of Lorca, who was by then had become a huge friend of Neruda, was a great shock. It led to Neruda abandoning his diplomatic neutrality, coming out clearly in favour of the Republican side. He was, of course, had to leave his job as a diplomat in Madrid, and he wrote this wonderful poem called Explico Algunas Cosas, Let Me Explain a Few Things, where he explains the change, the shift, metamorphosis of his poetry from this inward-looking anguish, really, of the love, 20 love poems, to this outward-looking fighting for social justice. Poetry became a weapon for social justice, humanity, solidarity. And this shift is explained very beautifully and lyrically in that poem.
Explico algunas cosas. It's a lovely title. I explain a few things. It's a very modest title for what's to come.
The poet Jane Duran, whose father was a friend of both Federico García Lorca and Pablo Neruda, and who himself became a soldier for the Republic and fought right through the Civil War.
And the poem begins, Preguntaréis, ¿y dónde están las lilas? You will ask, and where are the lilacs, and the metaphysical blanket of poppies, and the rain that often struck your words, filling them with holes and birds? I am going to tell you all that is happening to me. And then he says, do you remember, Rafael? Federico, do you remember under the ground? Do you remember my house with balconies where June light smothered flowers in your mouth? Of course, at the time when he wrote this poem, Federico would have been assassinated. So that's particularly powerful. And then he says, y una mañana todo estaba ardiendo. So he says, and one morning all was aflame, and one morning the fires came out of the earth, devouring people. And then he says, and through the streets the blood of the children ran simply like children's blood, which is such a powerful thing to say. And then he goes on and he says, treacherous generals, look at my dead house, look at broken Spain. But what is extraordinary is the way this poem ends. And to me, the turn in this poem is like the turn the whole of his poetry then takes from the time of Spain onwards. He says, you will ask, why does your poetry not speak to us of sleep, of the leaves, of the great volcanoes of your native land? Come and see the blood in the streets. Come and see the blood in the streets. Come and see the blood in the streets. Each of those lines is different. He cuts it off in a different place, so you have to focus. Come and see the blood in the streets is one line. And then he says, come and see, another line, the blood in the streets. And then the next line, come and see the blood. And the next line, in the streets. So this to me is some of the most extraordinary lines ever written. Why is it so powerful? Why is it so poetic? It's so simple. It's so direct. And after everything he said, he's changed his whole way, I think, of writing poetry.
Can I just take you back to the Valencia Writers' mm-hmm. Congress? Yes. Now, this is right in the middle of the Spanish Civil War, which ran from 36 to 39. The Republic summoned all these writers in order to get these people to support them against Franco's uprising. Now, actually, the Congress was torn apart. There were great political differences. The year 1937 is also the year in which Stalin is starting the purges, the show trials in Russia. And Stalin, was killing his enemies, and he was pursuing them in Spain, Andrés Nin, and people were being hunted down. Now, did Neruda know about this or choose to ignore it?
Gosh, what a question. He certainly knew later. Of course, that Congress, the Valencia Congress, was dominated by attacks on André Gide, who'd written this book, Retour de l'URSS. He'd just come back from the USSR, and he said, it's not what people are saying. It's not this wonderful experiment. The people are being oppressed.
Millions have died of starvation.
Millions have died. He said he gave a lot of that. Of course, that Congress turned into a support for Stalinism and Stalin. There was no mention at all of the murder of Andrés Nin. It did turn into this post-Stalin rally almost.
Jason Wilson, can you tell us about that split between Octavio Paz and Pablo Neruda? Because both of them were at the Valencia Writers' Congress. And Octavio Paz, who was on the left, became less of a Stalinist, but Pablo Neruda became more of one.
They confronted themselves in Mexico City over the role of poetry. What is the role of the poet? Paz said, well, he's to go on writing poems. If you're going to be political, it's better to write pamphlets. And they actually came to hitting each other. There was a sort of confrontation. In a way, Neruda won that because he was surrounded by a gang of fellow-thinking people. And Paz was out on a limb because at that time you had to make a decision. And Paz was separating writing poetry from the political. But it was a crucial moment, in a way, for Latin American literature.
Octavio Paz said that Stalinism poisoned Neruda's poetry.
Yes, he did say that. If one reads the poetry from the 40s onwards to his death and the posthumous poetry, I think you can see almost everywhere, even the famous odes, to a tomato, there's some line that comes out as a sort of ideological rigidity. In a way, Neruda loses the kind of freedom, exploratory freedom, that his early poetry had.
There was a famous occasion he quotes in his memoirs where he was talking to some workers in a market, and he suddenly realised they're his audience, they are his key audience. He wanted poetry, suddenly felt, to be like bread. That's something he comes back to many times through his career. And in his 1971 Nobel Prize speech, he again refers himself, poets should be like bakers. The word should be like bread for the ordinary man to be consumed. He didn't like that hermetic, difficult poetry that he wrote earlier on. So I don't call it bombast. I would say it simplified his way of looking at the world later on.
Well, he also said, you could take all my poems and throw them away, but there is one poem you cannot destroy, and that is The Winnipeg. Let us talk about The Winnipeg, because it's actually 70 years ago that this happened.
Misión de amor.
Mission of love.
Mi navío esperaba con su remoto nombre, Winnipeg.
My boat was waiting with its far-off name, Winnipeg, tied to the jetty of the burning garden, to the old bitter grapes of Europe.
In the winter of 1938-1939, as the Spanish Republic began losing the civil war against Franco's nationalists, who had military support from fascist Italy and Nazi Germany, some 500,000 Spanish refugees trekked over the Pyrenees into exile in southern France. Disarmed and disheartened, they were penned in a series of bleak concentration camps guarded by Senegalese and other French soldiers. But for some of the refugees, a few of them, there was a chance of getting away, by boat, to the New World. The anarchist writer and publisher Stuart Christie, who in the 1960s spent 3 years in jail in Spain for plotting to assassinate General Franco, explains how this rescue scheme worked.
The main organisation responsible for the exodus of refugees was the SERI, the Sociedad de Españoles Refugiados en el Extranjero.
Okay, the Society of Spaniards Who Are Refugees Abroad.
Which was set up by the government of Dr. Juan Negrín.
Now, Negrín was a communist, wasn't he?
Negrín was a communist, yes, a Stalinist, as was the government, you know, basically the whole of his government in exile, but they had access to the funds. There was also South American governments also appointed people to handle the refugee question from Mexico, from Argentina, the Dominican Republic, and Chile. And in the case of Chile, there was a special consul appointed by the Popular Front president, Pedro Aguirre Cerda. And the man he appointed was the Chilean poet Pablo Neruda, who had previously been consul in Barcelona from 1934, and then in Madrid. Now, he was asked to leave, I believe, Spain in November 1936 for activities which were inappropriate for diplomatic activity. I believe he became associated with Soviet agents and the Communist Party during that period.
Now, this is a special appointment in 1939 that he gets from the president of Chile to be the consul for Spanish emigration. I mean, he's not a regular. He's sent over to Europe to do this.
Specifically for that purpose, to coordinate the exodus of Spanish refugees. He also, his role was to actually select the people who would be allowed permission to enter Chile.
De campos y prisiones, de las arenas negras del Sahara, de ásperos escondrijos donde yacieron hambrientos y desnudos.
From camps and prisons, from the black sands of the Sahara, from bitter bolt holes where they lay hungry and naked, there to my clean boat, to set off to sea towards hope. They came, called one by one by me from their jails.
Now, how did this selection work, and what was he doing?
Well, I believe he personally supervised and personally took the decision on a number, perhaps maybe 100, maybe 200 people, individuals. But he personally did intervene in the case of at least one friend of mine, a guy called José Peretz, who was the Spanish anarchist historian. He was also one of those who came across with the 26th Army Division. And they were actually aboard the boat, and they were turfed off to make way for other Stalinists.
I wrote a book called Spanish Marxism versus Soviet Communism, A History of the POUM, the party in which your colleague George Orwell fought, the Workers' Party of Marxist Unity in Spain.
Stephen Schwartz also found evidence that Neruda prevented some people from leaving.
And in doing research on the Spanish Civil War and the role of the POUM and the anarchists, I read a person that we consider the greatest on-the-ground historian of the Spanish anarchist movement, a man named Peretz, José Peretz, a very great historian, worked to very high standard, always worked with original sources. I didn't connect that up to Neruda until several years later when a short text of Peretz called Author's Appendix to Anarchists in the Spanish Revolution was published. And that described something that I had heard about and read some articles about but didn't know much about. And that was the fact that when this relief ship, the Winnipeg, was commissioned to take Spanish refugees from France to Chile, that Neruda, as a Chilean diplomat, had gone aboard the ship and taken off of the ship anybody who was either an anti-Stalinist socialist, an anarchist, or a Pumist. There were a couple of exceptions, but one of the people he had taken off the ship was a Spanish painter and poet and Trotskyist named Eugenio Fernandez Granet. And Granet wrote a personal description of being taken off the Winnipeg. Peretz wrote a description of how Neruda had gone and taken people off the Winnipeg. And a Spanish anarchist writer named Fernando Solano Palacio wrote quite a lot of material about the scandal of Neruda going aboard the Winnipeg and taking people off and basically leaving them in France, which at that point was threatened by the Nazis.
A la esperanza acudieron llamados uno a uno por mí.
They came, called one by one by me, from their jails, from the fortresses of wobbling France, summoned by my mouth. They came.
I've got here in my hand an appendix to Anarchists in the Spanish Revolution by José Peretz, and he says the author of this text, i.e. himself, after a few days aboard the Mexique, he was cross-examined by Señor Gamboa, Fernando Gamboa, another communist, who made him disembark along with 350 libertarians who were sent back to concentration camps. And then he says here, the poet Pablo Neruda also prevented him from sailing to Chile aboard the Winnipeg. And he eventually managed to cross the Atlantic on La Salle. Peretz himself says that Neruda excluded him.
The case of Peretz really bothered me, because if we had lost Peretz, because 40,000 of the Spanish Republican exiles living in France at the time of the fall of France, 40,000 of them were deported to the German Nazi camps. And if Peretz had been deported to Mauthausen or Auschwitz, and had died, we would not have his historical record of the Spanish anarchist movement, which would be a tremendous loss. Literally every important historian of the Spanish War from Hugh Thomas on drew on Peretz. This would have been a horrible loss.
Do you think that Pablo Neruda, as a Stalinist, was deliberately excluding anarchists from the boat?
I'm absolutely convinced. I mean, his original brief was to organize the evacuation of a broad cross-section of Spanish Republicans, fishermen, peasants, workers, intellectuals, as they described it, quote, a sample of force, heroism, and labor.
Saavedra, dije, y vino el albañil. Zúñiga, dije, y allí estaba.
Saavedra, I said, and the carpenter came. Zúñiga, I said, and he was there. Rosas, I called, and he arrived with a tight smile. I shouted Alberti, and with hands of quartz, poetry appeared. Ploughmen, carpenters, fishermen, potters, mechanics, tilers, tanners came to fill up my boat that sailed for my country.
But the reality of his role was effectively to filter out anarchist libertarians, Trotskyists, anti-Stalinist socialists and anarcho-syndicalists, people who had been opposed and who had resisted the Green government.
Now, the criticisms come, as you'd expect, from Trotskyists.
Adam Feinstein, Neruda's biographer, like the anarchist historian José Peyrats, also went to first-hand sources.
I was lucky enough to talk to many of the passengers on the Winnipeg. Two of them have become very prominent artists in Chile, José Bru and José Balmes. Another one, Victor Pey, prominent engineer, and also was one of those who harboured Neruda in hiding in the 1947-48.
That was in the Cold War when Neruda was being persecuted as a communist senator, and this man who he had saved from Europe looked after him, hid him in his flat before getting him over the border into Argentina.
So he paid him back, 48-49, paid him back for the rescuing him on this ship.
Señor, ¿me puedes decir tu nombre? ¿Quién es usted? Dime tu nombre.
Victor Pey Casado.
Victor Pey Casado. Señor Victor Pey, una cosa...
Victor Pey, there is something I want to ask you. A man has written that in the choosing of people for the Winnipeg, that there were people on the boat who were taken off the boat on the orders of Pablo Neruda. Have you heard any idea about this? Have you heard anything about this? That on Neruda's word, they took people off the boat. This is not true, senor. This is not true. Who or where do these stories come from, do you think? There are many stories like this. It's not just the Winnipeg. It's full of errors. Some are simple errors, involuntary errors, and others have political ends. I'm not a communist. I've never been a communist. But neither have I been an anti-communist. I will tell you, nobody was asked if they were a communist as a condition to get onto the boat. I want to say the following. The immense majority of the people of the 1,500 on the boat were not communists. So these fables are fables that have been used for political ends. And they do not correspond with reality. I tell you with the intention of paying honor to the truth, the historical truth. Neruda was a man, of course. He had some dignity, but he also had defects and faults like all men. But he did not impose communism as a reason for getting onto this boat, as people have said.
Victor Pey, muchísimas gracias. ¿Eh?
Yo sentía en los dedos las semillas de España, que rescaté yo mismo y esparcí sobre el mar, dirigidas a la paz de las praderas.
I felt in my fingers the seeds of Spain, that I myself rescued and scattered over the sea, voyaging towards the peace of the prairies.
Stalin's trial against me is built upon false confessions, extorted by modern inquisitorial methods, in the interest of the ruling clique.
We have now seen that Stalin has been pursuing his enemy. The greatest enemy that he had was Leon Trotsky. Trotsky, again, had escaped from Norway by ship and was now living in Mexico.
There are no crime in history more terrible in intention and execution than the Moscow trials. His trials developed not from communism, not from socialism, but from Stalinism. That is, from the irresponsible despotism of the bureaucracy over the people. What is now my principal task? To reveal the truth.
His house in Coyoacán is still there. You can go there. And you can see in the walls the huge gouges where the machine gun bullets came. Because there was, before Trotsky was assassinated, there was a famous attack led on his house
by David Siqueiros, the famous muralist painter, who was another Stalinist. He led a gang of people, they machine-gunned and they threw firebombs in order to destroy the papers. Mm-hmm. Because historically at this moment, the show trials were going on, Trotsky was denouncing Stalin and had to be silenced.
I will never forget this moment. I was sitting in a college library in San Francisco, California. Wasn't a Stalinist anymore, and found out that the library had a copy of a book called Murder in Mexico, which was a sort of a semi-official report on the assassination of Trotsky, written by the chief Mexican investigator who had investigated the assassination. So I'm sitting there, turning the pages, reading the book, and what do I find? There on the page it says that after Siqueiros launched his attempt to kill Trotsky, in which one of Trotsky's guards was murdered, and Trotsky's grandson was shot in the foot at the age of 12, Pablo Neruda, who was not ambassador but general consul in Mexico City, arranged for his escape from Mexico. I looked at that and I thought, so Pablo Neruda was an accomplice in the conspiracy to murder Trotsky. That was a pretty shocking thing to see.
Siqueiros was arrested and put in jail. At this moment, Neruda comes as a consul to Mexico, and he gives Siqueiros a visa to go to Chile. So Siqueiros, who had attempted to kill Trotsky, is freed and let go. By the time this happens, Trotsky is dead, because Ramón Mercader has come and with the ice axe has killed Trotsky in his study. Now, of course, Neruda had nothing to do with the actual death of Trotsky. I'm not saying that. But what is this getting Siqueiros to Chile all about?
Well, I've looked at a lot of the papers now. Got to remember, Neruda very quickly made friends with all three of the muralists. Diego Rivera and Orozco became great friends, and a lot of people argue that his poetry changed. Certainly in Canto General you can see lots of...
It's a mural, isn't
it? It's a mural.
Yeah.
So Neruda then met Siqueiros in prison. It was quite a lax regime for him because he was so well known as a muralist. He could leave the prison quite a lot and go out, go to bars, have restaurant meals, as long as he came back in the evening. And so he got to know Neruda quite well there, and Siqueiros appealed to him. Neruda, as the consul in Mexico City at the time, I need your help here. Could you do something to help me? So Neruda then met the president at the time. Then there are various versions of this, but Siqueiros says that he thought he was being let out of prison that day, that morning, to his death. And he arrives at the house of the president, and the president says, we've heard that you're facing death threats from Trotskyists, and we need to get you out of Mexico as soon as possible, because you're liable to be killed if we leave you here. So he was granted this visa, and Neruda got into terrible trouble because it was without the permission of his own government. And in fact, he was allowed a visa to go to Chile, to Chillán, where he painted a famous mural, and stayed quite a while in Chile. And Neruda was sacked, or temporarily forced to leave his job for about a month. And you could argue that that 1 month's temporary dismissal from his post fed a lot of the writing of Machu Picchu, Altura de Machu Picchu, for instance, and this new acquaintance with the pre-Columbian traditions of Central America he got from that 1 month's travel, that, thanks to being temporarily relieved of his post by the Chilean government.
This is true. Mm-hmm. We've mentioned that Canto General, in a sense, is a kind of a mural, but the heights of Machu Picchu, Las Alturas de Machu Picchu, is also a kind of mural. If you look at the Rivera and Siqueiros pictures, they're trying to do the race, you know, the rise of civilizations and the ordinary workers and the peasants. And it's a bit like Soviet social realist paintings, which depict happy workers and peasants and seven brave tractor drivers and all those sort of things. The heights of Machu Picchu, I think Jason Wilson has said, is written with Stalinist steel.
That is his word. That is the word that Jason uses. It is, I agree. But Neruda was too independent a spirit to follow a fixed literary line. However long he clung to Stalinism politically, and he did cling to it much longer than many other people did, but he wasn't capable of following a political line in his poetry. He would have hated that idea.
Machu Picchu, pusiste piedra, y en la base harapo, carbón sobre carbón, y en el fondo la lágrima, fuego en el oro y en el temblando el rojo, goterón de la...
In some cases, when you combine his extraordinary way of invoking the Latin American landscape, his sort of earthiness and his mysticism, and you combine all this with a tremendous sympathy for people who have been oppressed. The combination can be very powerful, as in The Heights of Machu Picchu. Juan split stones, Juan corta piedras, son of Wiracocha, Juan cold belly, heir of the green star, Juan barefoot, grandson to the turquoise, rising to birth with me as my own brother.
I mean, I agree there's a kind of brotherhood here, but I find myself strangely unmoved by that. I mean, he's kind of co-opted the American Indian experience of building these civilizations unto himself. It doesn't work for me.
But it's like a great big torrential river, and I think that is unusual and extraordinary.
It was October 1943 when Pablo Neruda went by mule up from the Urubamba Valley in Peru to the Incan ruins above and had his epical vision of the American continent from the heights of Machu Picchu. At the same time, over on the Eurasian continent, the Second World War was raging. On the Eastern Front, Stalin's soldiers of the USSR, having saved Stalingrad and won the huge tank battle of Kursk in the summer of 1943, were pushing back Hitler's Wehrmacht and Luftwaffe at a vast expense of blood and treasure. Maybe 30 million Russians were sacrificed in what they still call the Great Patriotic War. And Pablo Neruda's admiration for Joseph Stalin never diminished. This is part of the ode that Neruda wrote after Stalin died in March 1953.
To be men, that is the Stalinist law. We must learn from Stalin, his sincere intensity, his concrete clarity. Stalin is the noon, the maturity of man and the peoples. Stalinists, let us bear this title with pride. Stalinist workers, clerks, women, take care of this day.
But here was this record piling up of being involved in the assassination of Trotsky, being involved in taking people off of the ship Winnipeg. I also already knew about his really scandalous poetry in favor of Stalin.
The light has not vanished. The fire has not disappeared. There is only the growth of light, bread, fire, and hope in Stalin's invincible time. In recent years...
And his unbelievably wretched, there's no other word to describe it, his wretched ode on the death of Stalin. And the fourth thing that sort of drove the nail in the coffin of Neruda the man was finding out that he had abandoned his daughter, Malva, who had Down syndrome, in Europe when he went back to Latin America. Well, this, to me, added up to a pretty bad guy.
Now, Pablo Neruda made a terrific friendship with Federico Garcia Lorca. Lorca said a very interesting thing about Neruda. He said that he was closer to death than to philosophy, closer to pain than to intelligence, closer to blood than to ink. Jason Wilson, what does that mean?
It's a fascinating comment. The early source of Neruda's understanding of himself is this notion of having been abandoned. Abandoned by his mother, so there's a sort of psychological, biographical thing, but also abandoned as a lover. His great love poems are all love poems about loss.
Pensar que no la tengo. Sentir que la he perdido.
To think I do not have her. To feel that I have lost her. To hear the immense night, still more immense without her. And the verse falls to my soul like dew to the pasture.
Lorca's the same. So they both work. Now, both of them are thinking poets. I want to put that in inverted commas. But the thinking is not out of the Enlightenment rationalist tradition. So one gets a series of metaphors that they're talking about. The only metaphor in what you quoted to me was, of course, blood ink one.
But there are these two lines, because if you take the two lists, there's death, pain, blood, and then on the other side, there's philosophy, intelligence, ink.
Yeah.
So
decoding that, it makes it a very clear series of sort of oppositions that are two traditions. You know, the one, as I say, you could call it the Western philosophical tradition, where rationality, you know, thankfully, thank God for rationality, but, you know, it is at a premium. But then you get this other mode of understanding, probably best by Freud. What pulses generate meaning in our lives? Well, they're in unconscious pulses, which come out in dreams and come out in metaphor rather than in literal description. And they knew that the real self was at this murky, darker level, and they could only point towards it as pain, darkness. The early title of Neruda's Residence on Earth was Colección Nocturna, Nocturnal Collection. He was aware of night and darkness.
And Crepusculario was before that.
Yeah, exactly. Very famous book for him, that one. Neruda did an awful lot of reading, particularly in Ceylon, Sri Lanka today. And he read Eliot, and he read Aldous Huxley, and he read D.H. Lawrence. Now, when Lawrence died, he said he was one of the greatest poets he'd read. He was reading him in English. So there's a link between Lawrence's thinking about where does meaning come from.
You know? Deep, dark belly blood, yes. To quote Lawrence
and
himself.
And I think the word blood links them.
Would you say then that Il Postino, this film where Philip Noiré plays this wise old man and you know, teaching love, as it were, has that carried on the myth of Neruda?
Well, this is a personal issue for me. At the end of the film, the Italian postman who had taken on this Cyrano de Bergerac role of asking Neruda to write love poems for him to give to the girl he was in love with ends up getting killed in a confrontation with police at a communist demonstration. So Il Postino is not morally, shall we say, one-sided. Il Postino does show that there was another side to the whole Neruda question, and it portrays him as something of an egomaniac. But I don't think in the final reckoning of things, Il Postino had the effect that was intended. When it was announced that the Motion Picture Academy of Arts and Sciences had 15 nominations for Oscars for Il Postino, and Miramax Studios produced a feature, an hour-long feature, in support of the Oscar nominations about Pablo Neruda, and they had a guy there, on there. He had on a Mexican sombrero, and he was carrying a guitar, and he said very solemnly, "Pablo Neruda is the greatest poet in the history of the Spanish language." Now, that is a statement that is so utterly absurd. It is beyond imagining, because Spanish is one of the very greatest of the European literary traditions. If you look at the list of the great Spanish poets, Neruda is not very high on the list. So there was this whole promotion, the idea they were going to get 15 Oscars. So I wrote a long article, which appeared in a small magazine and then was condensed in the Los Angeles Times, in which I quoted several lines from the Ode to Stalin, and they ended up with one Oscar, which was for the musical score. And I was very happy after that. I take personal responsibility for that.
We've looked at some difficulties and some troubles here. This is not a simple man. This is a man who liked dressing up, a man who was secretive, a man who changed his name, a man who is unreliable in all sorts of ways. But finally, in your view, is he a great man and a great poet?
Oh, gosh. He's certainly a great poet. He's lots of men. That's the thing about Neruda. He recognised it in that poem called Muchos Somos, where he's talking about we're many people in one. And he also calls himself Mi Perfido Enemigo. Pablo Neruda, my treacherous enemy, Pablo Neruda. He knew that he was various different people. Of course he must have felt guilty about abandoning his only child. He must have felt that. There are certain elements of his life which cannot be justified. He's a great man in terms of his art, of how great he can make you feel about the world. He's great in that sense. A great artist, a great poet, one of the greatest poets in the 20th century. As a great man, he had some areas of his life which could have been improved, shall we say, but I think we'd have to accept those without justifying them.
Pablo Neruda's biographer, Adam Feinstein, concluding Closer to Blood Than Ink, which was presented by Nick Rankin. The reader was Stephen Critchlow and the producer, Julian May. This is Radio 3. It's now just after 11:15. Our essay comes from India tonight. It's the final episode in our week of essays that have come from various parts of the world, considering the legacy of Dr. Johnson. And tonight's essay considers his influence on Indian English. Post-colonial Johnson is at 11. And in half an hour from now, Lopa Katare talks to Nick Page and Bernard O'Neill, who've been collaborating on a new project this year, the fruits of which they took to the stage of the WOMAD Festival. And you can hear what they got up to at 11:15 in World on 3. But with a little time to go before that, music by Mendelssohn, written when he was still an adolescent, but his pen doing here brilliantly what Shakespeare said of the poet's pen in the very play this music was composed for, led by the poet's eye, that in a fine frenzy rolling doth glance from heaven to earth, from earth to heaven, and as imagination bodies forth the forms of things unknown, the poet's pen turns them to shapes and gives to airy nothing a local habitation and a name.
Thank you. And so the dream of Raff evaporates with what always seems to me to be a question.
Was it a dream? A Midsummer Night's Dream, the overture that captures all the magic of the play. Mendelssohn's overture, played there by the orchestra of the 18th century, conducted by Franz Bruggen.
A glorious Humperdinck confection comes to the BBC Proms on Tuesday, Hansel and Gretel. Laurent Pelly's semi-stage production of the Brothers Grimm fairy tale is performed by the Glyndebourne Festival Opera with a cast led by Alice Coote and Lydia Teuscher. And there's sure to be some drama from the Wicked Witch, who is uproariously played by tenor Wolfgang Applinger Speerhacker. Hansel and Gretel at the BBC Proms. Tuesday evening at 7 o'clock here on BBC Radio 3.